saving money in your next project when you shop at Menards. We have everything you need for keeping your outdoor power equipment in tip-top shape. Ensure your lawnmower or boat is running smooth this year. Right now, all FVP lawn and garden and marine batteries are on sale. View our entire selection of FVP batteries today on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer for all of the great deals happening this week. Save big money at Menards.
Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I am Al Hunt. This week, our guest is the co-founder and executive vice president of the Quincy Institute and an expert on Iran, Trita Parsi. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write to politicswarroom@gmail.com for next week's show. Now, we're going to get to as many as we can, but please don't forget to tell us where you're from. You also can get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. Tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Mint Mobile and 3-Day Blinds, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. James, there's several things we know about Trump. He loves to lash out and hurt people, and his administration is like the mafia. They command total loyalty or else. This week, after threatening to obliterate the entire Iranian civilization, attacking one of his rare European allies, Italian Prime Minister Meloni, and continuing an assault on Pope Leo, the first American pope, he went on a truth social binge throughout the night, much of it making little sense. All this is best explained by a Peter Baker article in the New York Times. Basically, Trump is a guy playing on the mental edge. It's a powerful and really important piece. And the Atlantic's Tom Nichols, who I don't know but I respect, said the public and the press can't look away and really must focus on this president's deterioration. You can't look at Trump's behavior and not conclude there are serious cognitive issues here. He's viciously attacked all sorts of people. He loves to do that. War heroes like McCain, women, people of color, immigration, those with disabilities. Pretty much gotten away with it. But to shift to politics for just a moment, the attacks on the Pope and putting up an AI image of himself as Jesus, I think that's going to endure. That's going to be a bigger, more enduring problem. The Pope is enormously popular with Americans. The former Latin American cardinal, he identifies with Latinos, where Trump is in trouble anyway. The Catholic Church is actually growing in America, and if you look at the last two election returns, Biden narrowly carried Catholics in 2020. Trump carried it by more than 10 points, providing his margin of victory in 24. So it's stupid politics, and I'll tell you this much. If it's Pope Leo against Crazy Donald, my money is on the Chicago guy.
Yeah, I suspect there's something more at work here than just stupid. And with Trump, it's a little bit like, you remember the story you read about the little boy that cried wolf. And so we've been saying Trump's crazy, and keeps going. And was he more crazy today or less crazy yesterday? But I think that he's turned a corner in a really substantial way. And you mentioned two things that I think are very important. It's the Peter Baker piece in the Times. As you know, they've really resisted talking about whatever mental personality issues he have, et cetera, et cetera. Tom Nichols, who I don't think I know by reputation, I think he's a kind of national security defense guy or something like that. I mean, basically, he said it's time to be aware. And I assume that he has very deep sources in the national security community. It's a bad situation right now. And I honestly, I've cried wolf so many times, but I think this time the wolf. I really do. I think we're on a short leash. I really do.
You know, James, I tell you, Trump had a terrible week. And I think the only way he leaves office is if his family somehow persuades him, because I don't think he's going to leave office otherwise. I hope he does, but I'm dubious of that. I'll tell you who else who had a bad week. It's the guy who would succeed him if he does leave office, J.D. Vance. You know, the negotiations in Pakistan were hardly a success. I think we'll come back. We'll talk to Trita about that. His guy, Orban, that he campaigned for, was shellacked in Hungary, thank God. And then this converted Catholic, J.D. Vance, gave the Pope a lesson on theology and basically suggested that he shut up. J.D. Vance is really, you know, I had somebody today call and they asked the question seriously. I don't think it's accurate, but they said, do you think there's any chance that Trump was really just trying to set up J.D. Vance for failure because he realizes that, you know, he's not a worthy successor? Well, number one, I don't think that's right. But number two, you wouldn't put it beyond Trump because he is, as we said, cognitively challenged, crazy. Trump and Vance certainly doesn't look like a worthy successor, does he?
Yeah, I don't think it's intentional. I don't think his mind is capable of thinking like that anymore. I really believe that he would set up Vance by making him do a PCO he knew wasn't going to happen, and he'd set up Vance and send him to Hungary when he knew that Marvin would lose. I could understand why people would think that. I don't think Trump is capable of that cognitive level of thinking. I really don't. But, you know, I'm sure that Maggie and Jonathan Swain are going to have, remember that book is coming out in June. That there are two mega events that are going to happen that are just people can't fit, and you can't factor them in, but how big the Haberman Swain book is going to be and other books that are coming out over the summer. And no one is prepared for the force that this election is going to hit in November. It's going to hit like a, I don't know, Category 12 tsunami, hurricane, I don't know, tornado, whatever. It's going to be so big, American politics not going to be the same. And all assumptions, I don't think, can figure out how big this election is going to be and the effect it's going to have on Trump. His mental state is deteriorating by the hour. You ain't seen nothing till November, if he's still there, which I am very doubtful of.
Yeah, yeah. There's no question of that. You know, I said earlier that they act like a mafia. He went and he demanded that Jay Powell resign from the Fed when his chairmanship is up March 15th. No, his membership in the Fed, not his chair, his membership continues for years more. Trump has no right to fire him. Says he's going to, which would violate the rule of law, which, of course, Trump doesn't believe in to begin with. But this is exactly what these people are. It really is much, much more like the Gambino gang than it is the president of the United States. And it's not going to get better. There's no one around him who will say to him, Mr. President, you cannot do that. They have to start off by saying, sir, because, you know, it's written in the Trump Constitution. You have to call him sir. I just see nothing that gives me any hope that things will get anything but worse. I hope you're right. He'll be out of there. I'm skeptical.
Well, I'll say what I think he will. A year ago, people paid attention to what he said. Even people that didn't like him had to. And every day that goes by, this sounds right. Weird. I know he's president of the United States. I know he has a figure about nuclear trigger. I know all of that. People are giving less shit what he says. Foreign leaders, voters, politicians. And he's not it's not the same job he had a year ago. And it's clearly not going to be the same job come November. The job has an ebb and a flow to it. It has a certain amount of statutory and constitutional power, but that he's going to lose most of that coming too. I just don't see this guy being president of the United States by this time next year. I'm increasingly believe that we're on a much shorter leash than that. It's the rate of deterioration. I don't have to be a neurologist or anything like that. I mean, we've all seen it. And you're looking at it right in front of your eyes. And it's not wishful thinking. It's not projecting. It's just what's happening.
Well, it certainly is happening. There's no question of that. You know, James, the other, there was another big story this week that wasn't, well, I'm not going to say it wasn't as good for the Democrat. The Democrats have a contest, governor of California. For the last 16 years, they have had two heavyweight governors, whether you agree or disagree with them, Jerry Brown and Gavin Newsom. They have gone, and as you have reminded me, they have helped create and nourish the fourth largest economy in the world. California is not a basket case. It's actually, for all of its problems, doing pretty damn well. They have a contest this year. They had eight Democrats, at least, in there, two Republicans. Trump did a big favor. There was a chance the two Republicans would finish first, but Trump endorsed one, which means he's going to get a little more votes, but the other guy's not going to finish second. He may finish fifth, sixth, whatever happens. But on the Democratic side, I guess the general front runner was Eric Swalwell, who ended up a sexual abuser and pervert, had to drop out not only the race, but of Congress. And now it's a field of no one that really looks very impressive. There are a bunch of people down the line, the mayor of San Jose, the former attorney general, the former mayor of Los Angeles, but they're only getting 3%, 4%, 5% in the vote. Maybe one of them will take off. Happened before with Gray Davis back in 1998. I think it's unlikely. And so the two next behind Swalwell were first, you know, Tom Steyer, who was a billionaire, who's now decided to move far to the left in his campaign and is flooding the airwaves with ads. Not a bad guy, but not someone you'd say is one of the more impressive people, you know, in politics. And then Katie Porter, a liberal. She's one of those liberals, James, who loves humanity, but really is very nasty to human beings. That's not really a good sort of person you want to lead the state. So if I had to guess right now, and it would really be just a guess, I would guess Steyer will win. There'll be a runoff. Steyer will beat the Republicans. And I hope he's able to keep California in an even keel.
Well, I'm not worried about it. I mean, first of all, okay, so Swalwell was a good candidate, all right? He's gone. And so, wait, you got the mayor of San Jose, which I think is the second largest city in California. It might be third, but it's either second or third. It's a huge place. You got the former attorney general. Mm-hmm. You got the former mayor. Mm-hmm. It does seem like a pretty stout field to me. And the only... It'll adjust. The polling will adjust as you get closer to election day. Steyer is obviously a successful entrepreneur, environmentalist. I know him. He moved left. I think he was trying to run for president, but the country is moving, getting ready to move left. I got news for you, man. They'll have to see how they play out, but got a pretty good hand here still. Pretty good hand.
Well, it's a winning hand. I don't think it's a good hand, but it's a winning hand. And moving left, I mean, Steyer is now for Medicare for all. He's adopted the Bernie agenda. I don't think the country's moving that far left. I really don't.
Maybe
but,
not.
You know, he's going to win. He won't be able to do most of it. And, you know, we'll see.
I think the status field plays out. It might play much better than we think, but I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I think it'll play out with a Democratic victory. That's at least assured. Anyway, okay.
Save on wireless with Mint Mobile. Only if you like to save money. If you don't care about money, it makes no sense. However, if you like to get a really good product at a cheaper rate than anywhere else, it makes all the sense in the world. That's my test. If you like money, you like this. If you don't like money, you don't like it.
Yeah, if you're like James and me, you like to know what's happening to your money and keeping as much of it as you can. Unfortunately, traditional big wireless carriers seem to like keeping our money, too. After years of overpaying for wireless, you know, you get fed up with the crazy high wireless bills, bogus fees, and free perks that actually cost more in the long run. And you can decide that making the switch to Mint Mobile is a no-brainer. Every month you wait is money that could be in your pocket. And we've seen how quick the savings add up when you take back control of your cell service. So stop overpaying for wireless just because that's how it's always been. Mint exists purely to fix that. We all deserve affordability, and Mint Mobile is here to rescue you with premium wireless plans starting at $15 a month. All plans come with a high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. It's easy. Bring your own phone and number. Activate with eSIM in minutes and start saving immediately. There are no long-term contracts, no hassle. It's time to ditch overpriced wireless and get 3 months of premium wireless service from Mint Mobile for $15 a month. With service and a price like that, we strongly recommend you make the switch. We might not be the most tech-savvy, but James and I both can handle this easily. The website is incredibly simple to navigate, and you're able to get down to business in no time. That's when we knew we all had to get it for our kids and grandkids, so they can use it too. Like all of you, they have a lot more important things to spend their money on. So if you like your money, Mint Mobile is for you. Shop plans at mintmobile.com/war room. That's mintmobile.com/war room. The link is in the show notes. Upfront payment of $45 for a 3 month 5 gigabyte plan required, equivalent to $15 per month. New customer offer for first 3 months only, then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See Mint Mobile for details. James, 5 weeks ago, Trita Parsi, a foremost expert on Iran, born there, left as a youngster. He's now working with the Quincy Institute for Better U.S.-Iranian Relations. He was a great guest. Trina, you have written insightfully, but as the situation changes, so does your analysis, as it should. Understanding that it could change overnight, assess where you think the Iran war is right now and who has the upper hand.
Well, the war itself has been nothing but an absolute disaster for the United States and also for Trump himself politically. And he was on the path towards an even greater political disaster for himself before he managed to get this ceasefire. I think it's important to recognize that the Iranians did not defeat the United States or Israel militarily necessarily, but this was a strategic defeat. This war should never have been started. The Iranians, and I think I mentioned it on your podcast last time, they had prepared for this war for more than 30 years. Their entire defense planning, the organizing principle of it has been to repel an invasion from the south by the United States. I doubt that the United States has prepared for this for 30 years. I think the organizing principle for the United States has been to be able to fight two major wars in two different continents and primarily against China over Taiwan rather than against Iran. Doesn't mean that there haven't been any planning on Iran, obviously, but nothing that was as central as it was for the Iranians. Now, because of the ceasefire, however, I do think that the momentum in certain aspects may have shifted in favor of Trump in at least one critical aspect. Talks are ongoing. There's likely going to be another round in the next couple of days. Whether they succeed or not remains to be seen, of course. But Trump can actually walk away from those talks with no agreement, and he will still have achieved his main objective, which is at this point, which is to get out of this war and make sure that it doesn't end his presidency, destroy his presidency in the manner that the Iraq war destroyed the legacy of George W. Bush. The Iranians, however, have not yet achieved their main objective, and that is to translate this strategic victory into a new arrangement with the United States that entails a lot of lifting of sanctions on Iran. That can only be achieved through an agreement. So in some ways, the Iranians are now in greater need of an agreement than Trump is, because Trump has already secured a key thing he wants. He's out of this war. Does not mean that it's a good situation for the U.S. if there isn't an agreement. The Iranians will, for instance, continue to control the Strait of Hormuz. They will let the oil flow, but they will charge a fee. But oil prices eventually will come down. But from Trump's perspective at this point, this is obviously not his original objectives. The real objective was to just get out of this disaster that he put himself in. And that has already been achieved through the ceasefire.
So if they go back, as they say they're going to Islamabad, I assume, what are they going to deal? Trump's already basically achieved what he wants. So the Iranians would love to have, some of the
Sanctions released.
compensation for the damage, have sanctions lifted. I'm doubtful Trump will do that, but I don't know. What do you think?
I actually think that if there's any American president that would be open to lifting sanctions, if he gets kind of nuclear concessions and other things that will enable him to say that I got a better deal than Obama, I think he'll go for the sanctions relief, because Trump seems to have an ideological skepticism against sanctions. He sees that the sanctions are ultimately targeting American companies and preventing American companies from getting into various markets. It is not the Iranians that are necessarily preventing the U.S. from coming in. The primary objective obstacle is these U.S. sanctions that go all the way back to Bill Clinton's first presidency. So yeah. I think with the right type of an arrangement, I think Trump does not pay the same type of a political cost for lifting sanctions as other presidents did. I mean, just take a look what happened a couple of months ago. He lifted the Caesar sanctions in Congress on Syria, on the guy who was the head of Al-Qaeda in Syria when they were killing American soldiers. And he did that through Congress, because it was a congressional act that only Congress could lift. Most of the primary sanctions on Iran are executive orders. Again, dating back to Clinton era, executive orders 12959 and 12957. These he can actually lift with the stroke of a pen. Will he take a lot of political criticism for it inside of the Beltway? Of course he will. Does he care? I don't think so. Not that much, at least, because if he can say, look, I got these nuclear concessions and now I've opened up this market for American companies, that will go down much better in the broader American public than any of the criticisms on why did you lift sanctions on Iran? I mean, what was the narrative outside of the Beltway on lifting sanctions on Syria? I don't think there was anything.
Yeah, no, there wasn't. Trita, I let's assume it doesn't go quite as smoothly as all this. And it goes on for a while. Do you expect the Iranians to respond to attack the U.S. Blockade?
It depends on whether this is a real blockade or if this is a bit of a stunt, a bit of a negotiating tactic. Because if this is a real blockade, we have to remember 80% of Iran's oil is being sent to China. You stop those ships, you're actually stopping the Chinese from getting the oil that they have already purchased. You're going to pick that fight with China right before the summit in Beijing with Xi? I'm skeptical. Would they go after some ships to just demonstrate a little bit? Yes. But if it would end up becoming a full-scale blockade that would actually be fully implemented, then that clearly is a major escalation, and I suspect the Iranians will respond. Will they respond militarily? Perhaps not in the first instance, because we're still within a ceasefire. Now it's just gone towards some sort of economic warfare. I suspect that a more likely response by the Iranians will be to convince the Houthis to close the Red Sea. That would take another 12% of the oil flow off of the market, dramatically push up oil prices, and that will hurt Trump far more than his blockade of a blockade will hurt the Iranians.
Yeah, and you know, it's pretty hard to stop that. Look, Trump's assumption, Trump's assumption and Iran's assumption is who can endure the pain the longest. That's pretty clear cut, isn't it? The Iranians can endure the pain the longest, however great it is.
Of course, because at the end of the day, it's not actually the U.S. enduring the pain. It's whether Trump can endure the political right. pain before November. And I don't think he can. I think he was actually quite desperate in getting that ceasefire. That's why his first tweet said that the ceasefire would be based on the negotiations would be based on Iran's 10 points that they had sent the United States rather than the U.S.'s 15-point proposal.
Yeah.
So I think he needed to quickly get out of this because oil prices and other things, which probably would have gone up dramatically within a week or two after that day when the ceasefire was struck, had there not been a ceasefire, would have been devastating for him. So I think he read that right. He got out. And the question now is getting out sufficient for him, or will he go further and actually strike a broader deal? Because one of the drawbacks of not striking a deal is also he will not have a resolution to the nuclear question. And at some point, he's going to have to deal with that issue.
James.
So let's project forward 2028 as a presidential election return. And let's project forward from the vantage point of the 90, almost 95 million people that live in Iran. There's a lot of people there. In your opinion, what would be, in a range of possibilities, the best way best place for the Iranian people to be in the year 2028, the worst place it could be, and where does it likely end up? What are we likely looking at in 2028?
Well, first we have to then point out that in two very significant ways, they're already worse off. First of all, a large number of them have been killed, and the Israelis and the United States have devastated a large part of Iran's industrial base and infrastructure. And it will really set the country back, and they will be struggling even further. There's a report that is published on responsible statecraft that shows that about 5% of the Iranian population have been pushed into poverty as a direct result of this war. So this war, under no circumstance, was in any way, shape, or form good for Iranians. The idea that this war would have overthrown the regime, I think, was a fantasy from the outset. It's as if we never experienced Iraq or Afghanistan or Libya or any of these other places. Secondly, you, of course, have the situation in which the Iranian theocracy has been strengthened as a result of this war. They have a firmer grip of society than they did before this war. They have shown that they have survived. They have beaten back two superpowers that are nuclearly equipped. We did not see any major protests since the war started, despite the fact that arguably there were a few opportunities in which the population could have taken to the streets. They did not. So I think that the theocracy comes out stronger in a firmer control of the society. And their supreme leader has magically de-aged about 30 years as a result of what Israel and the United States did to his father. And he's now taking over the supreme leader's son at age 56 or so. And his father was 87 or something, has now taken over. So first of all, we have to recognize that the baseline is much worse than it was before. But going forward, I do think that the best way to be able to help and empower Iranian civil society is actually to lift these sanctions. The idea that these sanctions have actually weakened the regime is true, but it has weakened society far more than that. And it's the relative power between the two that matters. When Trump reimposed all of the sanctions in 2018 and 2019, when he walked out of the JCPOA that Obama had negotiated. And on top of that, he added a bunch of new sanctions. Just in those 2 years, Iran's middle class was slashed. One third of it went into poverty, or actually went to the strata below middle class as a direct result of these sanctions. So the idea that you actually could bring about that type of internal change driven by a society that is decimated by sanction, that is impoverished by sanctions, is just a complete fantasy. If the JCPOA had stayed in place, if Trump had never pulled out of it, and 10 years had passed, I think the Iranian civil society and society as a whole would be much stronger by 2025, 26. The middle class would probably have become the strongest one in the Middle East, if not the top three ones at least. Between 2015 and 2016 and 2017, the Iranian economy grew about 6 to 7% because of the lifting of the sanctions. Imagining that continuing for a decade, you would have seen protests, in my estimation, in 2025, but it would be from a society that would be demanding changes from a position of strength rather than what we saw in December 2025, in which they were out in the streets from a position of despair and desperation. So hopefully we will have learned from that lesson. We would recognize that if we actually want to see that type of a positive change in Iran, it's going to take some time, but it has to be done by Iranian society itself. And the worst thing we can do is to decimate the very elements that we're hoping, that we're banking on bringing about that change through these different sanctions.
Before I turn you up, three facts that I repeat, but I want you to tell me if they're true or not, because if they're not, I'm going to stop repeating them. One is Iran publishes more books than every Arab nation combined. Does that sound true to you?
That's the statistics actually of Iraq before the Iraq War. Iraq back then was publishing more than 50% of all Arab literature in the entire Arab world. Iran, of course, is not an Arab country, so it doesn't publish anything in Arabic. It publishes in Persian. But I would suspect, and I can't claim to know, that the Iranians are producing even more than what Iraq was doing back then. It is an extremely literate society. It has a very long, very strong tradition. It has a tremendous amount of respect for science. That is why Iran, despite 47 years of sanctions and isolation, is one of 11 countries that can put a satellite in space, that has managed to produce all of these missiles, et cetera, more or less indigenously because of that importance that they put on science and STEM. And incidentally, it's also part of the reason why the Israelis bombed the best universities in Iran, is all part of an effort to truly push back Iran.
Another statistic that I've heard, just verify, half the people in Iran have a college degree, and of those, over half are female.
Yes, that is correct. I think it's actually okay. Higher than that. In fact, in some ways, it's become a problem for them. They are producing graduate students far more effectively than they're producing jobs that are high-end. And that is, again, part of the problem with the sanctions. The sanctions doesn't set back the universities as much, but it has set back the economy. And that's part of the reason why you also had a brain drain. A lot of educated people that they produce, but they have to leave the country because they can't get jobs.
Yeah, what I'm trying to do is get at the fact that a lot of Americans say, well, this is just another, you know, country. No, it's a very sophisticated civilization that you deal with, and very clever people. I mean, these are not people that just, you know, would say here, just fell off the turnip truck. It's an old civilization.
And, you know, what people can do to kind of says it, just go and check like these math and physics and chemistry Olympiads that are done every year with, you know, some of the best students in the world competing. Just go and check and see how often the Iranians are winning gold in all of these different STEM areas.
So I'm going to turn it back to Al, but when we started this, as I understand it, there was a anti-government, there was a resistance in Iran. People were getting sick of the mullahs, looking and seeing that they weren't doing as well. As a result of this incursion or excursion or whatever, I don't know what it is, either, is the government position been strengthened, weakened, or about the same?
No, it has been strengthened.
People we don't like very much is what I'm talking about.
It has undoubtedly been strengthened. The question is, however, has it been strengthened in a long-term way, or is it just a short-term rallying around the flag, which is a very natural phenomenon in every country that is the subject of an aggression? I do think that once this war is over, this government is going to have to deal with a society that is still very, very angry at it, wishes it away by and large. But there are parts of the government's narrative that has been vindicated in the eyes of even some of its strongest critics inside of that society, which is that this war was not against the regime. This war was against Iran as a country. That's part of the reason why they went after the infrastructure, why they were bombing the universities, why Trump was talking about destroying Iranian civilization. All of those things, all of those very unfortunate, mistaken moves have really played into the hand of the government, who said, it's not because of the policies of the government, it's because the West and Israel in particular do not want to see a powerful Iran, and they're doing everything they can to set it back.
Thank you. Thank you. I have much clearer understanding. What a disaster, Albert.
So what, you know, pick up on that. Elaborate a little bit more. Let's say, you know, things end the way we're talking about. Look, 2-3 years down the road, they may be even more repressive at first, but could you see a movement towards loosening, towards, I hate to use the term democratizing, but you know what I mean, or will forces like the Revolutionary Guard just absolutely never permit that?
So I think one thing that's very important to understand, many of these elements would never want to permit any of these things. So it's not whether they permit it, it's whether if they no longer have the power to stop it.
Right.
And that's why it's so important to actually not pursue policies that disempower the society that is the society that has to be able to be strong enough to make sure that they can get these changes regardless of whether the Revolutionary Guards accept it or don't accept it. All of these major things that have happened has not happened because the IRGC necessarily wanted it. The JCPOA, for instance, or the election of Rouhani in 2013. It's because they couldn't stand in the way of it. And that necessitates, again, a strong society. And we don't have as strong of a society as could be the case in Iran right now, to a very large extent, because of the sanctions, but also other factors, the repression of the government itself. I can see that perhaps there is a path in which this government will recognize after this that its own treatment of its own people is actually a national security threat. Because you have to have a lot of very, very angry Iranians that are so angry that they become viable converts or defectors, as the Mossad has been pursuing a lot of inroads inside of Iran. And clearly, they had managed to get a lot of inroads. The fact that they had so many options is because there was such a large number of Iranians that were so angry at their own government and were willing to collaborate with Israelis. So if they don't want that to happen again, they have to recognize that their repression of the population, their refusal to meet them halfway, is actually a national security threat, because it ultimately not only brought about a war, but it also makes sure that within that war or preceding that war, the Israelis had a shocking level of intelligence inside of Iran.
And Trina, where, when this is settled, or you know, however we call it settled, where is this going to leave Israel, and where is it going to leave Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf states?
So with the Israelis, it very much depends on exactly how this ends. The Israeli preference is that it doesn't end in a ceasefire. They were against a ceasefire. They wanted to stop. They want the United States to go back into war. If Iran has been set back 20 years, that's good for Israel from their standpoint, but it would be even better if it's set back 50 years to bomb it even further. And as Trump said, bomb it back to the Stone Age. So that would be their preference. Whether they can push things in that direction, or whether they can sabotage a lot in order to make sure that that ends up becoming the only viable alternative, remains to be seen. But there's a scenario in which Trump walks away, he doesn't get a deal, but he just refuses to go back to war. And it would raise a question as to whether the Israelis would continue the war on their own. I have a hard time seeing it, perhaps for a short while, but they actually cannot sustain that war against Iran without massive and active American support and help. And I don't think they also wanted to be in a scenario in which they're at war with Iran and the U.S. is out, because that would have enabled the Iranians to strategically separate Israel from the United States.
Right. And how about the Saudis?
I think the GCC states are in a very, very dire situation, at least some of them. Because first of all, they're very angry at Iran, because Iran has been bombing several of them, or more or less all of them at this point, targeting American bases and assets, but also going beyond that. And their whole bet on all of these American bases, I think altogether 19 American bases in the Middle East, was supposed to deter Iran from attacking them and deter a war. But it turns out that it was the United States itself that started the war. And then within that war, these bases did not become a protection for them. Instead, they became magnets, the source for these attacks, the targets of these attacks. So I doubt that they will go back towards paying for the rebuilding of all of these different bases. They will obviously retain a security relationship with the United States, probably buy more weapons, but they will also diversify, try to find other security partners. And some of them will conclude that geography leaves them with no other option but to try to find some sort of a relationship with Iran.
Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. You're a terrific guest. We may want to have you on every 5 weeks now, but we
hopefully not.
I hope the war doesn't go on. I hope there are other reasons to have you on. Trina, thank you. Really,
thank you so much for having me.
You have educated us.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me.
Get your room right with 3 Day Blinds. To me, it's everything. I having a pitch black room is number one, getting a good night's sleep. And this stuff really works. I recommend it highly.
You know, when you want to upgrade your home, wandering through endless aisles at the store and finding an attendant is exhausting, especially when glaring sunlight coming through your old busted blinds woke you up at dawn. It's 2026, not 2006, so if your blinds are stuck in the past, there's a better way to buy blinds. Shutters, shades, and drapery, called 3 Day Blinds. They are the leading manufacturer of high-quality custom window treatments in the United States, and right now, if you use our URL, 3dayblinds.com/warroom, they are running a buy one, get one 50% off deal. Now, we shop for almost everything at home, so shop for blinds there, too. 3 Day Blinds, local, professionally trained design consultants, average 10-plus years of experience in providing expert guidance on the right blinds for you.
all in the comfort of your home. Just set up an appointment and you'll get a free, no obligation quote the same day. We love that the expert team at 3-Day Blinds handles it all. Measuring and installing blinds can be a big challenge. So they design, measure, and install for you. That way you can sit back, relax, and leave the heavy lifting to the pros. Once we heard about them, we knew it was time to upgrade. Their blinds come in thousands of options that fit any budget or style. So it's an easy sell on the family. With 3-Day Blinds, we're excited to be getting better sleep and opening and closing our motorized blinds from the comfort of our beds. Alexa, I slept great. Now let there be light. They are a real upgrade, not just a replacement, and we know you'll like your 3-Day Blinds as much as we do. Now, right now, get quality window treatments that fit your budget with 3-Day Blinds. Head to 3dayblinds.com/warroom for their buy one, get one 50% off deal on custom blinds, shades, shutters, and drapery. For a free, no charge, no obligation consultation, just head to 3dayblinds.com/warroom. One last time, that's buy one, get one 50% off when you head to the number 3daybyblinds.com/warroom. The link is in our show notes. And now for the outrage of the week, James. Two Republicans in the U.S. Court of Appeals overturned District Court Judge James Boasberg's continuing efforts to hold the Trump administration accountable for blatantly ignoring a court order last year to halt deportations of migrants to El Salvador. It was a 2-1 decision, and the dissenting judge warned this decision is going to encourage other officials to ignore court orders. This is what I think this is all about. Judge Naomi Roe and Justin Walker are the two Republicans. These Republican circuit court judges know there may well be a vacancy on the Supreme Court this year. The word is that Justice Alito is likely to retire. He has a book coming out in October, the same week the court returns from its summer recess. You know, authors usually spend weeks plugging their books in New York, L.A., Houston, Miami, wherever. Hard to do that and be a full-time justice. So I think what Roe and Walker know is that if there's any anti-Trump ruling from them, that would automatically disqualify them from his consideration when there is a vacancy. So what some of these judicial decisions really are tryouts for Trump's favor.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are two headlines I saw today, and I want to speak specifically to groups like the Financial Roundtable, the Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, all these high-end groups. One headline is in the Financial Times, and it reads, Wall Street banks break records on Iran war drives trading boom. Okay? This is from the Financial Times. That they're making more money on Wall Street as a result of this war than any time they have before in a comparable period. This from something called Oil Price, which is an oil industry publication. This is not any kind of environmental things. World's top oil companies to rake in extra $234 billion in war profits. Now, my point is this. This is all going to come out. People are feeling this. It's not just a talking point. The middle class is getting crushed. The oil companies are experiencing record profits. Wall Street banks are experiencing record profits. If you don't come up with an idea how to reallocate some of the fruits of capitalism, then people are going to come up with the idea for you, and you're not going to like it. But I'm telling you that when you have something this idiotic like this war, that's driving trading profits to an all-time high and driving all company profits to an all-time high and driving a majority of the American people in a financial ditch, be aware change is coming. What I would suggest that you do is get on the right side of the change and start formulating policies that you can exist with that go toward reallocating this, but this is not going to keep up, people. I got to tell you, I'm becoming a little more left-wing economically about a month. I'm hardly where a lot of these people are, but.
Oh, hell by the day, James.
They're going to have to do something because something is going to get done to them. And when all of the corruption and the profiteering comes out, yeah, people are going to, they're not aware of how big it is. They know it's out there. It's bigger than you think. The other thing I was going to do, but I'm not going to do it, but I highly recommend in the New York Review of Books to read Bill McKibben's article on Stars and Stripes. I was leaving my outrage. They're trying to destroy Stars and Stripes. It's been around. It's a military newspaper. It's been around since the Civil War. Patton tried to screw with it. Eisenhower himself said, leave Stars and Stripes alone. They do these cartoons and everything. And they're coming after that. And as the journalism ought to be, and McKibben's not a writer or anything, but the article is really worth reading. They don't even think the soldiers can able to read for themselves. It's really that bad.
I guess they figure if they can start to destroy the Naval Academy and the Military Academy in West Point, you know, why not go after Stars and Stripes? Because that's what they're doing to the academies.
They are.
All right, now to our favorite segment, questions from our very smart, informed, challenging listeners. James Eric in Lacey, Washington says, why doesn't Senator John Fetterman switch to the Republican Party? He's a fixture on Fox News and agrees with most of the Trump policies.
I'm not a big Fetterman fan. There's tons of judges that he voted for. I think the guy just wants to get his name in the paper. And he may switch because they're going to correctly say if he wants to run again, I don't know, but most politicians do. He has no chance in a Democratic primary. If I'm the Republicans, I go to Fetterman. I said, if you switch, your final 2 years in the Senate, we'll give you prime committee assignments. You'll be relevant. You'll be loved in here. And that's why I'm saying the Democrats need to have a big year in the Senate because picking up 4 seats may not be enough. That's a real threat. Now, if we pick up, as I suspect, more than 4 seats, they'll tell them, shove it, man. Go where the fuck you want to go. But you ain't going to win. You certainly not going to win a Democratic primary. We're not going to clear the primary. And you go, dude. But this is a very real possibility. And this makes these Senate races even more critical than they've ever been before.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And it leads to our next question, which is from Will in Boise, Idaho. What would it realistically take for an independent to win a Senate race in a state like Idaho? There's a guy named Todd Achilles who is running against a rather unpopular incumbent senator in Idaho. In Montana, which is an open seat, there's Seth Bodner with that incredible resume who is running against a Republican who slipped in there with a sweetheart deal. And in Nebraska, a guy named Dan Osborne, who ran a pretty good race last time, is running. The experts, the smart people would tell you there is no chance. But I'll tell you what I'll do. I will take a parlay. I will bet right now that at least one of those three will win in November.
So let me introduce you to Senator Angus King, independent Maine. Okay? Do I care if it's Angus King?
Well, yes.
Again, if they caucus with the Democrats, call themselves whatever you want. But I'd rather have Seth Bonner than have
that's what they would do.
Right. By the way, this is something I'll say. I don't think if we're either going to win all three or lose all three. I don't think we're going to go 1-for-3. I think it's going to be things are really going to happen big. If they do, we're going to win them in places that you can't imagine. If it's just a good election that Democrats have, maybe not. But I think we got to prepare for just a monster year. In that case, you might win all three of them.
If you win all three of them, you're going to probably pick up, you know, 8 or 10 seats. If you don't win any of them, the Fetterman nightmare could come true. They're really interesting. They are really.
So let me put, while we're doing this, in the last quarter, you know how much money Tal Rico has raised? $27 million. You know how much John Cornyn has raised? $1.7 million. I'm sorry. That's just what happened. I don't see how we could be in any better shape in Texas than we are. Now, if Cornyn, if he wins that primary, the special interest money will pour in, but Tal Rico's just ringing it up like crazy.
Yeah. Steve in Hot Spring, Arkansas, James, wants to ask you, who or what is required to charge a war crime?
Oh, God.
Topical.
That's a little bit above our pay grade. There are such things as war crimes. There is an international court. Well, I don't think we're a signatory, but we could turn some.
Well, there's a tribunal, right, that can charge a war crime.
He's so many crimes. He knows even what.
I probably should have picked another question, but I do think, James, that it's if he's charged by the International War Crime Tribunal, of which we are not a member, what it would mean, there's a case, certainly a case, and it would mean that he just can't travel anywhere. Tom, this is Tom is in London, UK via Naples, Florida. Tom, you travel a lot. He said, if Democrats turn to power in 2029, should they use the Bannon approach to flood the zone with a corrective implementation policy using their majority to simultaneously enact a myriad of structural changes to save our democracy and preserve our rights? Tom, I got some thoughts about what the Democrats should do. They return to power in 2029. But, you know, I haven't thought it through thoroughly yet. I'm really focused on what they should do when they win the House and maybe the Senate in 2027. And that's to hold Trump as accountable as they possibly can.
If the Democrats win the presidency in both houses of Congress, I think on day one they should make Puerto Rico D.C. a state, and they should expand the Supreme Court to 13. Fuck it. Eat our dust. They've done everything they could. That they held up the 2000 election. They stole it. They've stolen Supreme Court seats. They've gerrymandered everything that you can. And the only way to fight this is don't run on it. Don't talk about it. Just do it. She said, okay, we got 54 senators and we got 13 court members. Thank you. Goodbye. Because you're not going to get a fair shake any kind of way in this system. 18% of the United States elects 52 senators. Well, you're not going to make it equitable, but you'll make it better by adding Puerto Rico and D.C. Yeah. No problem. We got room on the floor.
James Mike in Uncasville, Connecticut. I want to know if Uncasville plays Cassville in football or basketball. But anyway, Mike, you can tell us that. It's in Connecticut. James, he's asking you, do you think Trump showing up at the Supreme Court during the birthright citizenship arguments was an attempt to intimidate the justices?
He's so fucking stupid. First of all, he picks up Pam Bondi at the Justice Department and fires her on the way to the Supreme Court. He goes there. They don't pay attention to him. So he gets out. He walks out in the snit. You know, I just tell these justices, you've kissed his ass so much. You've said he has unlimited power. He can do whatever he wants. If there's anybody whose pain that I'm enjoying, it's yours. You fucked up, people. You just did. You know, maybe you can make some rulings here, get somewhat right, but you've really screwed this country up when people were like dependent on having a strong Supreme Court.
Well, I think that's exactly what he had hoped to do. You know, a friend reminded me, it was like, remember that scene in The Godfather where there was a guy who was going to testify against the family at a Senate hearing, and Michael brings his brother over from Sicily, and he sits in the audience, and the guy was so goddamn scared that he changed his testimony. I think that's what Trump was hoping for. I don't think it worked. Shane in Minneapolis, Minnesota, says a few shows back, Al mentioned that more Americans now support the Palestinians than Israel, and he said this is a problem. Why is that a problem? Shane, what I said was it's a problem
for the Israelis and their supporters in America. And it is. I mean, basically, if Israel loses the bipartisan support that they have enjoyed for, 70 years, I think that is a real problem for them. And I think AIPAC is, which has become really a Republican-run organization, is endangering that. Israel does not need to become a partisan issue in America, but they are making it that way. That's what I said was the problem, not a problem in general.
If you think, as I do, that there should be a Jewish state in perpetuity on the banks of the Eastern Mediterranean, final borders subject to negotiation and change, this has been the worst time you could have. Because I do support the existence of state of Israel. I do support a Jewish state in the Eastern Mediterranean. However, this current Israeli government is making this position increasingly less likely to go on. And so what they're actually doing, and I hope that people who, and I don't know, people describe themselves as pro-Israel or this or that and different things, I would describe myself as a supporter of the Jewish state. He's hurt us, Netanyahu and Trump and AIPAC and the whole crowd. To those of us who believe in that cause, they're actually working against it. That's what I think.
No question. You know, if you're a pro-Zionist, anti-Netanyahu person, which I am, you are sometimes called, you're anti-Israel, even anti-Semitic. That is an utter, complete lie. And I think the person that's causing the greatest problems for Israel today is not people who hold that view, but it is Benjamin Netanyahu.
And that illusion, by the way, I want to see a star seeing young Jews under 35. I bet you Israel's not doing very well with them either.
Oh, really poorly. Right. We ought to have Jim on sometime soon. John in Chicago, James, he said, you guys have been talking about investigating corruption once the Democrats take over. I guess he's talking about 29. Should it be done like the 116 commission, which was actually a congressional commission or a special prosecutor? What's the best way to approach it?
I think it should be done in the Congress, and it should be public. And whatever evidence they have, they should turn over after they develop to the proper authorities. But I think people got to know what's going on, how much has been stolen, the magnitude of it. And the government should start to claw back, should sue them to get some of the money they stole back. I really believe that. But I think that we're capable of doing it. I think the Congress should have very public hearings on and limited to corruption. I know there's 1,000 other things you'd like to do and, stupid appointments and,
Are you talking 27 or 29, James?
27. I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Eight months.
I agree.
Right now.
This guy was asking 29. Yeah.
Yeah. No. All right. I'm sorry.
I agree with you totally.
We get started in 27.
No, the Congress clearly should do that. You know, I've been thinking a little bit about 29, even though a few minutes ago I said I don't. I think in 29, there ought to be serious consideration given to something like a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the South African model. I think you can get, a president can appoint, distinguished people, give them money, staff, subpoena power, and just, we want to get everything out that occurred during these bad times. But let's get there first.
Yeah, I agree. I agree.
These questions are terrific. If I did not get to yours this week, send it in again, and I promise I will try. It's a hard choice every week, and we'll try to get to yours next week. So thank you for sending them in. Thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Mint Mobile and 3-Day Blinds, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them because when you do, you help make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, Subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look. You also can find other shows you might enjoy in the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Now remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review, and we'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.